You're listening to Next Stop CPA, the official podcast for the CPA exam, brought to you by the AICPA.
Hey there, podcast listeners. Welcome to another episode of Next Stop CPA, the podcast focusing on all things CPA and CPA exam. Today, I'm joined by CPA exam writers and contributors, Mike Vanskoy, who's director of Solomon Edwards, and Jimmy Moe, who's a partner at Eisner Amper, as well as Carrie Chester, who's part of our AICPA exams team as the lead manager of exam operations and services. Thank you guys for joining us today. And I think we'll just jump right into it. You know, maybe Jimmy, you want to get us started? Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and what your role is with the exam and anything else you want to add about it.
I currently am a partner with Eisner Amper. I've been there for a little bit over 3 years, and my role at the at our Philadelphia office is I oversee our not-for-profit department. So anything that involves not-for-profit, tax, auditing, or consulting, I'm involved in to an extent. My main background is within auditing as well. I have over 19 years of experience working with other CPA firms such as KPMG and Grant Thornton. I did a stint as an internal audit manager for 3 years at a national service, social service organization in Omaha, Nebraska.
Very cool. And how long have you been working on the exam?
So I don't know. No, I'm just kidding. So I think I've been involved with the exam for since 2005, 2006. So that's probably about 13 to 14 years. Huh. And a little bit about what I do with the exam. I write and review and I mentor on questions involving FAR and then also AUD as well. And then I also have assisted the AICPA with writing some simulations as well.
Great. Thank you. Mike?
Thank you. Sure. Thank you for having me today. So currently I'm a director at Solomon Edwards. It's a professional services firm. And with that group, I do a lot of technical accounting consulting and project work for clients. Have experience, unfortunately, now that numbers over 20 years of experience, mainly in a technical accounting background. I have a lot of IFRS as well as US GAAP experience and actually spent a few years as a head of a global IFRS reporting group living abroad for a few years managing that. And in fact, it was the IFRS piece of this that got me into writing for the AICPA. So I've been writing for the AICPA since about 2007. I heard through a connection or networking that they were looking for people to write IFRS questions because back then we still had the pipe dream that we were going to converge IFRS and US GAAP. So I called at that point in time, we were still writing questions and Word documents and it was a very informal process. But I called the AICPA one day and just said, I think you guys need me to write questions for you. When they asked why I thought they would need me to write questions for them, I asked them how many IFRS writers they had and they said they had none. I said, okay, then they didn't argue very much with me and the rest is history, thankfully, but it's been a great experience. Starting with that, we did IFRS questions for a while. And then once it became evident that we weren't going to go down that path as a country, they kept me around and let me start doing US GAAP question writing as well. Very similar to Jimmy, cause we've been here just about the same amount of time. I write mainly for the FAR and BEC sections, review those two sections as well. And like Jimmy, we've been involved in writing a lot of simulations and task-based work for the AICPA.
Fun. And so, Carrie, Mike and Jimmy, they contribute to writing to the exam, but they don't actually work for the AICPA. They're not on the exams team. So can you tell us a little bit about your role with working with writers who work outside of the exams team and why it's so important to work with people all over based on whatever their subject matter expertise is?
Sure. So I'm the liaison between, they're independent contractors for the exam. So I work on the examinations team. I'm the liaison between the contractors and the staff. There are about 100 people who report to me that I use periodically throughout the year for either simulation development or multiple choice questions or MCQs. It's really important because this is the way we stay relevant. We stay current. We get ahead of any new standards. They're the eyes and ears for me. I know we have section technical managers and they have subcommittees that do that work too, but it's so important at the beginning of the process to have people who know what's happening. They're in industry, they're in academia, they're, you know, they have public or, you know, not for profit. That's the actual experience getting on the exam. So really staying current, I would say, is the most important.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And what's the recruitment process like for finding exam writers?
So sometimes they call us, like Mike did. We used to have a vendor that handled the relationship with the contractors. We've since brought that in-house, and that has become my primary role. So I've inherited a bunch of people. But I attend conferences and recruit through there, through exhibitor booths. I publish, I have my name in a couple different, like the state board, I don't know, periodicals, or I don't know how they send it out, but they, the bulletins, if you will, my name was on there, my name was on the website. But we've, now that we're at about 100, we're pretty much in a good cruising altitude, but I'm always accepting new people.
Awesome. So do you hear that, future CPA, CPAs out there? if you want to give back once you have that license, we're always looking for, you know, for people. And so Mike and Jimmy, Carrie was mentioning the importance of working with writers like you guys to contribute to the exam, so it always remains relevant and that we have people who have these areas of expertise like you do involved. Can you speak a little bit more about what a candidate should understand about what you do and why it's so important, if you want to expand on that? Mike?
Sure. Yeah, I think what we do, the reason I like enjoy doing this, and I'm sure Jimmy does as well, is for me, selfishly, on a personal standpoint, it's a great networking opportunity because we're working with people, you know, that are in academia, people that may be retired, people work for nonprofits, public companies, private companies. You get a mix of people across disciplines. It's not just financial people. You've got, you've got tax specialists, you've got, you know, attorneys, that sort of thing. So for me, it's a great learning opportunity, but what I find most important about what we're doing is, like Carrie mentioned, you know, there's always a criticism, especially if you're working for a company, when a new standard comes out, there's a lot of criticism of a lot of folks who are up there making the rules for the rest of us who don't have to implement the rules, right? So the best thing about being involved in here is that you are the eyes and ears, so we can work on this content, we can write questions that are relevant, that we think matter to the people that are going to have to do this work. So what's most important for a candidate to learn? What are they really going to be expected to do? What are they going to be expected to understand once they get that position? And it's also, and Jimmy and I have done this even at a personal level, each one of our conferences, when we get together to do writing, we often do presentation for CPE purposes. And I found myself trading, either handing out some of the presentations that I've done for people, or plagiarizing or borrowing presentations from others.
Not plagiarizing. I'm gonna say that out loud.
But using, you know, borrowing from each other, because if someone else out there that, you know, you're working with and doing some of this networking has a great idea, we were able to pass that. You know, there's a lot of knowledge transfer that goes on during these conferences as well. But the one thing that I do, the common thread I see under all of us, is that we really care about what we're doing and take it very seriously. So.
Thank you, Mike. Jimmy, anything you want to add on that?
So I think it's important as well for practitioners like Mike and myself to be there, because we know, especially in my line of work, what those individuals will be working on, what they need to know. And I think that's really important as we're writing questions, as we're not writing questions on very complex IFRS related things, because a lot of those individual target audience for the exam, they don't need to know that. So I think with us having the practical knowledge and skill set to develop those questions, I think it's very important for those target audiences as well. The other thing is, since we're writing on topics that are not ultimately finalized yet, we're actually getting a head start and learning about those topics, which is a great sell for us as writers to get a step up above our competition, and knowing that as well.
Bring that back to your own companies, essentially. Oh, that is a nice benefit. And so as individuals who do have a hand in the exam, I imagine there's a lot of security involved, and, you know, maybe confidentiality agreements that they might have to sign off on, Carrie.
Yes.
Because I think, like, once you tell somebody, hey, you know, I contribute to the exam, like maybe your sister's friends, coworkers, like, oh, my kid's about to take it. Can you give them some answers? Do you have pretty heavy measures in place to make sure the confidentiality is there?
Yes. So they have to sign a statement of confidentiality that we sign, statement of compliance, if you will. It's the same one as our staff signs. Mm-hmm. We also have a statement of work attached to a letter of agreement, more acronyms here, that talks about confidentiality. But they also realize that what they're writing could end up ultimately on the exam in the exact format that they wrote. So I am proud to say that the whole network takes it very seriously, and they understand the rules and really the consequences of breaking those rules, which I haven't had to enforce yet. So that's good.
which is prison for life.
It is. It is, in fact, prison for life. That's in the statement of work.
I will tell you that once my staff know that I write for the exam, I'm not sure it's the same way for you, Mike, and they fail it, they fell apart, I'm instantly the one to blame. So,
right, right. You can give them my number. They can blame me too.
No matter what the section is, even if you didn't contribute it to
doesn't
it,
matter
it at all yet.
You made it too hard.
That's right. I get that a lot too. So, but fortunately, being an accountant, not everyone's dying to know what you're doing every day anyway.
Right. That's very true.
Something some of our listeners can probably already relate to. Can you guys speak to a little bit about what's one of the most challenging things about creating the exam? Or if you have any sort of horror stories that you would want to share?
Well, I'd say the single most challenging thing about writing for the exam is writing the wrong answers.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy, particularly when you're doing multiple choice questions, the easiest thing to do is to write a question and know what the right answer is because you're testing a very specific topic. It's then you've got to write three wrong answers that are wrong, but they have to make sense. They can't be too tricky. They can't be too obviously wrong. They have to be good, plausible answers that make sense for someone who's taking the exam if they don't read something properly or they haven't studied properly enough, because the exam is designed to pass everyone who studies and takes the time to study for the exam. It's not designed to allow you to pass if you weren't diligent about studying. So for me, it's funny that at a very granular level, the hardest thing is to come up with wrong answers that make sense.
Jimmy, anything you want to add about
Sure. I think for me, the biggest challenge is time management. And I think Mike has mentioned, you know, while we all have our normal day jobs in addition to writing, but for me personally, I'm not an individual that can write a lot of questions in one sitting. So for me, I have to pace myself and be disciplined enough to make sure I hit those targets. So for example, if I have to write 10 questions, I know that typically I will write one question a day, and I have to force myself to do that so that if there are 15 days to go, I make sure to be diligent enough to plan to do that. The way I think in my mind, it's very hard for me to write 5 questions in one sitting. So even when we have our meetings, meetings where we write all together for 2 days, I normally just finish about 8 questions while helping others in my review and in mentoring capacity, just because my mind doesn't think like that, where I'm just constantly just generating like 5 or 10 questions every day. So for me, part of it is just making sure I'm diligent enough to pace myself, and doing so, writing good quality questions versus quality over quantity.
That's right.
For me,
makes sense.
So I wanted to mention part of the process, and you may want to just have this in the other podcast, but
yes,
just for the listeners, the writers, what they have to go through to write a question is not just write a question and you write 4 choices. You write the question, you write the answer, you write the plausible distractors, you have to write a rationale for why you're asking the question, why the answer is right, and why the other 3 are incorrect. They have to cite a reference, they have to code a skill level, then they submit it once.
Who do they submit to?
They submit it to a mentor. So Mike and Jimmy both are writers and mentors and reviewers at any point, any cycle, any writing drive. So in the mentor capacity, you have several writers who will submit questions to you. You give them feedback. Mm-hmm. They update it. That goes back and forth a couple times. We have a staff person, Tim Habick, who's a PhD in linguistics, who looks at it and cleans up the language and sends it back to the writers, and then it goes to the mentor again, and then it goes through Tim again. So when they have an item assignment of 10, and Jimmy said he got through 8 in 2 days, that's actually pretty amazing, because you have to write a couple on one topic and then change gears and write a couple more on a different topic. You'll be in one section, but you could have a vast array of different topics that you have to kind of change channels. So that, to me, it is, you have to really want to do this and give back to the profession and stay current. And the good thing is I always respect and appreciate that. And I'm always thankful for all their efforts. But I wanted to say it wasn't just writing a question and answer and
sending
it off. It's like it's belt and suspenders. You have to say why you're asking it, why it's okay to ask it, why this is right, and why those are wrong. So it's very fair.
Very intensive process.
For the candidate. Yes.
And there's...
That is one of the most fascinating things I've found out about the exam. So I'll plug it if you're going to covered in another podcast. I'll plug that podcast. But the analysis that goes around the linguistics, the language of writing a question, the ethics of writing a question, and the statistical analysis that goes into how questions are performing is one of the most fascinating things I learned when I started writing for the exam.
Was it interesting for you guys, you know, as someone who, both of you were once candidates, you know, however many years back, and you were sitting for the exam and studying for the exam and just knowing these are hard questions. And then years later, you know, kind of go behind the scenes and now you're part of that, you know, that process of developing the exams. Is it sort of an interesting transition for you?
I think it was for me, and I took the exam in 2000, 2001. So back in the day, it was when they only had the exam offered in May and November, and you had to take two sections on, I think it was a Saturday, and then the other two on a Sunday. So I took it all in one sitting. And to go from that transition to writing, I mean, it's definitely changing. Even the way that we're taught, you know, as Carrie mentioned, to write the questions, it's very, very different than the way that you write like a term paper for college, or even like a writing, just like fun writing, you know, like writing on Facebook or whatever kids write these days. So it's totally different. And to make sure that we always remember the rules. And it's not like we write every day of every month as well. We only write sporadically throughout the year. So for me, the linguistics person, Tim, is always a good constant reminder of what I need to always think about, because sometimes I forget about that stuff too.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. For me, it was even the challenge now writing a question. I always look at these questions and go, now after 20 years of experience, I think, oh, this seems easy. But when I was fresh out of college, it wasn't that easy. So that's always been the transition, is learning how to gauge myself over the first few years of writing is to find that right balance. And it's been helpful. I mentioned the different disciplines from which everyone comes. You know, I've had a few mentors here that were professors. And so it's been great working with professors, because they write questions. They know how to test people. They know how to get, you know, impart information, then try to get that information back out from someone. So that's the kind of experience that I've enjoyed. But it's just, yeah, it's a lot. It's easier to be on this side of it, but it's,
you get paid for this.
So it comes with a lot of challenges, but a lot of benefits as a result. It sort of forces you to stay on the front lines of what's going on in the profession, because you have to, right?
Yeah, you know, I think that's very important too, because, you know, as Mike mentioned, in terms of writing, when we're writing these questions and our mentors or the reviewers are reviewing it, you know, we have to make sure we understand it, but then we have to make sure that we are able to defend it if the individuals at the higher levels don't understand it 100% as well, because that's very challenging.
Are there questions that you write that ultimately don't make it onto the exam for whatever reason?
Yeah.
Yes.
And so earlier you guys were mentioning that sometimes you get together and write questions together as a group. So it sounds like there's a mix of independent writing and then group writing. Do you find that there's sort of, because the dynamic is different, sometimes you come out with different kinds of questions, or you're bouncing ideas off each other? And how often do you meet as a group? And I would imagine there's a lot of coordination involved, since we do have writers from all over the country, right?
Yeah, well, the conferences are held typically a couple of times a year. We'll get together for writing sessions for a couple of days. And those are the days where I mentioned earlier, so you'll have all the writers together in their groups, the reg writers, audit writers, FAR, BEC. And during those 2 days, that's when we have the CPE presentations at lunch. We have the AIS CPA team there. So particularly if there's been a change to the writing style, or if there's a change in some of the things, the lessons learned, I talked about all the analysis that's done. Some of the lessons learned from previous exam questions, they impart that to us, tell us that here's the kinds of things you need to watch for, here's the things that we're seeing. We get our report cards on the questions that we've written in the past, which is helpful. But having that group together, particularly if you have new writers, or maybe a writer who's writing on a topic they haven't written before, you know, it could even be me writing on a topic I haven't written before, having the ability to have a real-time conversation with someone, whether it's someone from the AICPA or someone else who can be a subject matter expert in this field. Like I mentioned, I've had mentors who are academics, and it's been great to sit down with them. If they're an expert, they've been teaching something for, you know, a couple of decades, then you can sit down and kind of pick their brains as much as you can to get something out of them. And that's what those conferences are helpful. The longer I went on as a writer, the more comfortable I got writing independently as well. particularly if the logistics don't work out and you can't make it to a conference, then I'll still sign up and say, hey, I can still do 10, 15, 20 questions, whatever you need. But what you miss is that a bit of that networking or the ability to walk up to the table and talk to Carrie or someone else on the team and say, hey, what do you guys really want out of this?
Mm-hmm. So I'm there. Tim Habick, who's the PhD in linguistics, is there. We have staff mentoring. Staff mentors are there. And they can just stand up and walk over and talk, but they also are sitting with their mentors. Mm-hmm. So it's an item writing workshop, and it's a day and a half-ish, 2 days, all over the country.
Do you usually get a near 100% attendance rate out of all the 100 writers?
So no. So I have a pool of 100 people, and per item writing drive, I'll select several, but not all of them. Mm-hmm. Usually we have about, I would say, 30 active writers per cycle and 12 reviewers, give or take, depending on how many items that we need.
So it's a process.
It is a process. It is a process, but I love it.
Nice. Yeah. And as we start to wrap up, Mike and Jimmy, are there any interesting memories that you can recall from your Canada days when you guys were in the trenches preparing for the exam, for those who are listening right now who could use a little bit of motivation and encouragement?
I mean, you know, jokingly aside, the exam will challenge you. So, you know, don't take it lightly. You know, I graduated from a good college, nationally ranked accounting program. So I thought I was a shoo-in to pass the exam on the first time. I failed miserably. given my, I was a new hire at KPMG at the time. So I, you know, I had a lot of responsibilities with my regular work, but to do that and then the study afterwards, I don't know if I should say it, but it sucks.
No, you could say it. It's something a lot of people can relate to, I'm sure.
Especially just, you know, graduating from college and studying, you know, finals and, you know, taking tests and college courses, and now to have a real job and have to study a lot. But I know, you know, don't take it lightly. And, you know, my advice for the candidates is definitely try to get this done and completed as soon as you can. The problem is that in external auditing, you know, the higher up you go in a company, the more you work there, the more responsibilities you'll have, which means the more time you'll need to commit to your job. So the last thing you want to do 4 years from now is to still have those hours, still work, quote, busy season hours, and then have to come home and study. So for me, because I failed, the first time I took it was in November, so I failed it. And then I had to go again right immediately and study for it in May. So my most interesting memory was I did not take it lightly the second time. I paid to get a review course done. I know a lot of CPA firms now help offer review courses, but for me at the time, I paid to take it. So I worked busy season hours starting in January. I had class from 6 to 9, Monday, Wednesday, and then Saturday from 9 to 5. So from January until April, in addition to working 50 to 60 hours, I had to go to this course, which I went every time. And then in April, I think I took a crash course as well, which was like a week straight after work of going to this class, plus 4 weekend days. So Saturday, Sunday, Saturday, Sunday, the 2 weekends right before the exam, and did an intense crash course, 12 hours each day with the same company to do it. And then in May, the second time I did pass the exam. But yeah, do not take it lightly. Try to get this done as soon as possible if you can.
So basically, to your friends and family, you were just like off the grid for quite a while?
Yeah, they understood the importance of this as well. So,
and that's key, having that support and people who do understand, and instead of discouraging you and, you know, kind of making you question it all. How about you, Mike? Any fond memories or nightmarish memories that you could share? And
yeah, my experience was slightly different, but it's importance. What it taught me is the importance of having a habit and being able to get into a routine. So like Jimmy, I graduated in May, spent that summer going through a review course. So every weekend, every Saturday morning, you know, is there for most of Saturday, going through the review course, doing the home, you know, doing flashcards on Sunday. I'd never done flashcards in my life, but when I started getting to the CPA exam and realized I need to memorize mnemonics, I need to learn, you know, rules, just some things that I could take with me because I was traveling a lot too in public accounting. So I needed something that I could literally, you know, carry with me in a car or on a plane that I could just pick up and read without dragging a bunch of stuff around. But I treated it like I was still in college, like I was still going to class, did the homework during the week. Fortunately, took the exam in November, passed it all the first time. So, but anyway, like Jimmy mentioned back then, you're sitting in, you know, an arena for a couple of days with, you know, hundreds of your best friends taking the CPA exam. And we all knew when we got the mail, whether we passed or failed, because in the mail, if you got this very small letter sized envelope, you didn't pass all the parts. But if you got this huge package that would have a certificate in it with all this great thing that told you passed. And mine came to me on a Saturday morning on Super Bowl weekend. And I was already planning a big Super Bowl party. I get a call from my condo office that says, hey, we've got a big package for you. Went running down to the condo office. It said it was from, you know, the State Board of Accountancy. So that made Super Bowl weekend great.
Thank you, guys. And yeah, that really speaks to the importance of having a strategy when you're getting into this, when you're first starting your exam journey. You really need to plan out your time. And that's been sort of a theme, is time management and how important it is. But thank you guys so much. Really appreciate your time today. And you know, for anybody out there, once you're a CPA, if you are thinking of becoming an exam writer, now you know a little bit more about what the process is like and can give back to the profession. And Carrie, Jimmy, Mike, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Next Stop CPA. Got an idea for an upcoming episode topic, or just want to let us know what you think of the podcast? Share your thoughts with us at nextstopcpa@aicpa-cima.com. And don't forget to visit aicpa.org/CPA exam for the latest exam info.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or aicpa.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and aicpa.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.